Get a full body reset anywhere you go with Dr. Teal's Magnesium Spray. It's a concentrated magnesium blend of pure Epsom and Dead Sea salts, all bundled up in a convenient on-the-go bottle. A few quick sprays will relax your body and mind and keep you feeling recharged all day long. It's wellness you can feel, and you can find it in your local bath aisle. Dr. Teal's. Yep, you needed that.
During Memorial Day at Lowe's, shop household must-haves for less. Save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Grill to chef up something special. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep things fresh. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/27. While supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. So, Justine, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm excited to talk to you. I got to have one of the perks of being the true crime binge host is I get sneak peeks of podcasts. And I just spent the last hour listening to episode one of your upcoming show, Believe Her, and I'm already hooked.
Great. That's what we want.
That was the idea, right? That,
you didn't want me to that's the plan.
This is garbage.
Yeah. Don't care about the next thing. Don't want to know any more about it. That's enough.
Really good. And this is very timely for us when this airs. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It was great timing for the release of your show. And we at True Crime Binge were trying to highlight some domestic violence cases during this month. So the timing is working out perfectly. But we'll get into the case in a minute. First, I want to let the audience know a little bit about you. So I'm speaking with Justin Vanderloon, and I had to write that in my phonetic spelling.
Justine.
You're not Justin?
Not Justin. You got the last name, but then the first one.
I spent 5 minutes before we started recording making sure I spelled out exactly how to pronounce your last name.
You got it right.
You did. Right.
Yeah.
Justine Vanderloon.
Right.
You're an independent journalist. Tell us a little bit about you. I have a whole list of your CV, but you'll be better off explaining to us who you are, what your background is before you became a podcaster or about to become a podcaster once people get to hear your show.
Yeah. Do I count as a podcaster? I've never identified as a podcaster.
Listen, people ask that all the time. They're like, well, I'm not a professional. I'm not a podcaster.
Right.
I just made a podcast. But the entire industry is full of I'm a fireman. Everybody just makes one. And then I think we're just all podcasters.
Well, then I'm a podcaster.
Welcome to the club.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I'm a journalist. I'm a podcaster. For the past 3 years, I've been working almost exclusively on issues concerning sort of the intersection of women and the criminal legal system, particularly how and why women end up in prison, which I think is sort of a very ill understood topic. So that's been kind of my focus, looking at that specifically of 230,000 women in prison in America, women and girls in correctional facilities in America. So that's almost a quarter million people. It's more than any other country in the world. And that's kind of been my focus for the last 3 years. Prior to that, I was writing about immigration. I did a book about actually a murder case in South Africa at the end of apartheid. Yeah. Those are the highlights, I guess, the most recent highlights.
So you've got a few books I see you wrote a book called We Are Not Such Things.
Right. Yeah, that's about South Africa.
Okay. And then what do I have? Marcus of Umbria, What an Italian Dog Taught an American Girl About Love.
That was a different life, but yes. Yes, and
that sounds
hard-hitting journalism, and I actually also prior to that co-wrote the memoir of an Italian wine cellar. But that was long ago, you know, that was, and I wasn't a journalist then. I was just like, I didn't even think you could be that. I just happened to become one sort of accidentally when I was doing the book in South Africa. And I was like, I'm so nosy and I'm so obsessive. And I really want to go up to everyone that I think seems interesting and be like, can I ask you all the questions about your life? It's not appropriate. But if you're a journalist, it's appropriate. In fact, it's necessary.
You mean you can't just go around doing that to people?
You can't do that in real life if you're just a civilian. However, if you're a journalist, you can say, can I see all your papers? Can I look through everything? Can I put this together? And can you just tell me your deepest secrets for years? And people are like, I guess so, you know? Okay.
So you're a journalist.
You're a journalist.
I wonder if that works for podcasters now that you're a podcaster, if you can say, I am a podcaster. I seem to have good people tell me shit that they definitely shouldn't tell me all the time.
I mean, or maybe they should tell you, you know, maybe they should. Right. I'll keep it at that. Like, you should tell us. Tell us.
Right. Tell the podcasters tell all everything of us that everything, we want to know. Right.
Of course, if a journalist were to call me, I'm like, no comment.
Right. I spent 16 years as a firefighter. So that was my classic. You know, they show up at every fire and that's what. That was always our response, no contest. But that was only because we always had, if you ended up on the news, the nightly news after a fire, then you had to buy the whole crew dinner. So we would avoid, that was our rule. So we had to, we all avoided the press altogether.
But that was a policy or an informal policy?
That was an informal policy.
Could it be pizza or did it have to be like appetizers and like, main courses? Because I feel like for pizza, I might do it. But if I had to buy everybody anything off the menu, it would be a deterrent.
Right. Well, I mean, it's dinner at the firehouse. So we lived there, you know, on 24-hour shift. So, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to a firehouse, but not a lot of appetizers being served. There's just big, giant, unhealthy meals is what we're cooking or buying pizza. But yeah, that was, it all started because we had a guy who loved, like, it was guy that what he would show up off duty to the fire and like not even go in. Then you'd watch the news at night and he's like, yeah, it was a big one. And he just was looking for the cameras.
So he had to start buying. So it was basically a way to get that poor guy who just loved to have a moment in the spotlight to buy dinner for everyone all the time. Okay.
Yeah. It began as the Don Hughes rule. Okay. And then over the years, it became the, if you're on the news, then you have to buy dinner rule.
But if you're just running by in the background, it doesn't count. You have to put yourself front and center and be talking.
Yeah, you have to be talking into a microphone.
Okay.
And the game gets harder as you progress through the ranks because as you become like the chief, then they really want to talk to you. And it's increasingly ruder for you to tell them that you have no comment.
You actually owe the public a comment, but at the same time, it's so costly for you.
Right. It's been my dog's had to go to the vet this week. I can't afford pizza for nine guys. So.
Right. So no comment to the public that pays taxes, that pay my salary and wants to know what happened, sir, with this deadly fire. Right. Okay. Right.
Yeah. I'm going to have to decline. So you start off as an author. Now I'm going to go out on a limb based on two of your books and say that, did you spend some time living in Italy or were you just interested in Italy?
I did live in Italy. I'm like, why are you bringing up? Don't bring up this book. This book. Do not read this book.
See, that's my investigative prowess.
Your investigative
prowess.
You looked at Amazon and you were like, what's this book from 2008?
She wrote two books, both about an Italian dog and an Italian wine.
I was going to write the Italian wine guy's book for him with him. And then I ended up in Italy traveling around. And then I ended up in a sheep farming village. And I met a sheep farmer and I didn't speak Italian, didn't speak English. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. And then we learned each other's languages eventually. And it wasn't a good idea, it turned out. But I did get a dog out of it who I brought back to America and who lived to the ripe old age of 15. Yeah.
And wrote a book about that.
And I did write a book about that long ago. Yes.
Is there anything that's happened in your life significant that you haven't written a book about?
Yes.
I'm just trying to get to know
Absolutely,
you. I know now
yes.
that you've gone to Italy. You had a dog for 15 years. You learned Italian.
I did. I got married. I moved to South Africa. I moved to Ethiopia. I moved back to New York.
I could have figured out the South Africa part.
The South Africa part. I had two daughters. Haven't written about any of that. Yeah.
None of that non-important stuff.
None of that stuff.
Right. So let's back up. Like, how did you end up in Italy? Like, did you go to school to be an author? Was it like an aspiring dream? Like, how do you go from Justine in high school to Justine learning Italian in a sheep village in Italy?
It's a good question. I went to college and I was in college and I wrote, I think I faxed a letter to the editor-in-chief of Oprah magazine. I was just looking for a job with words, I guess. And I think I maybe applied to some jobs and I remember faxing, sort of cold faxing a letter. Maybe I didn't fax it, but I feel like there was a fax involved. If you fact-checked me, that might not be true. And they I don't know, I was hired as an assistant there. I worked there for a few years. I am not great at working for people, I think, maybe. And so I just didn't really love working in an office, you know. I didn't shine. I was told that I was not living my best work life.
Did you get fired by Oprah?
I did not
get
fired.
Story end with you getting
I did not
fired
get fired.
Oprah?
I went to Oprah's birthday, which is also my birthday, and I received a hug from her, which was very warm and smelled very delicious. But she did not work
her
at the magazine.
Smelled delicious.
Oprah smelled delicious. Oprah's delicious smelling. She gave me a big hug. So those are the highlights. And then I just thought, you know, this really isn't for me. Like, I probably shouldn't be working in a, you know, corporate structure. And I, you know, met this wine seller who needed a co-writer for his book. So I was like, you know, I was making a pittance no matter what I did. So I was like, sure, like I'll write that. And I kind of, he took me around Italy to, I guess, meet wine makers and help show me his life. And we wrote that book. And then when I was there, I met this guy. I ended up staying there for a while. I found the dog, came back, and then like needed to, I guess, you know, make a living, basically. So I was like living on some island out, Long Island, I was living on with this
just
dog, and I wrote that book. Long Island. It wasn't really, I mean, maybe it's not even a line. And maybe it's not even an island. Is it an island? I guess it technically must be.
I don't think they'd call it Long Island if it wasn't, but I don't know.
Yeah. It didn't feel like I was going to an island. It just felt like I was driving from Manhattan. But anyways, I ended up living there for a little while and just kind of freelanced. And that's how I end. Like, that's basically it. I ended up meeting my husband. He is South African and he wanted to go back to South Africa for a little while. So we ended up moving there and I needed to write something there, which is how I found this story about this woman named Amy Beale, who was... I was really fascinated by South African townships. I'm not sure if you're familiar with South African townships, but they are an apartheid era creation where the government basically like separated people into, I believe it was four races that they defined as races, and they would put them in different like actual areas and kind of homelands. And the townships were for Black people. But of course, even after apartheid, they remained. And I was very curious about the history of this. I could see them when I was, you know, driving back and forth. And I learned about this story about this American woman named Amy Beale who was killed near the end of apartheid. And I started looking into it. I thought it would be kind of an inspirational story because her mom sort of forgave the men who were convicted of her murder and they forged ahead in the new South Africa. But it became an a piece of 5-year long investigative journalism, which is when I was like, oh, I think I'm a journalist. That seems to be the right fit. And that was 2011. So since then, that's what I've been doing.
Nice.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
And you have won and been finalist for multiple journalism awards throughout your career. So you seem to be a good journalist.
Thanks. I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, there are people, yeah. People in the journalist world that think that you are a good journalist. I want to circle back to some of the work that you're talking about now, because I find it really interesting. The women in prison, like you said, 230,000 women are in American prisons. I've never done any like deep dive study into it, but I've seen like a lot of statistics that you might be able to share or expand upon. Like, I've looked at cases where there seems to be an overwhelming lopsided majority of women who are convicted when say a husband is killed, a woman will get convicted many more times than if a wife is killed, then the husband would get convicted. I've seen studies where if a child dies, things like a child being left in a car, like the stats are staggering. If it was a man who left the child in the car, more times than not, it's deemed an accident. And if a woman is the one that does it, then it ends up being like murder charges filed or manslaughter charges filed. And the sentiment has always been that like people have this like weird bias that because you're a woman, you must be motherly and you have more responsibility. Does any of that ring true to you, or am I just repeating what some other podcaster said?
No, I mean, that's really interesting. I didn't know about that. I find the data on the criminal legal system really very sparse. We don't have very much. Mm-hmm. But I think that idea of women being held particularly responsible, for example, for like a child's death is really interesting. There's a type of law called a failure to protect law that's used in just horrible ways, in which you'll have a woman, I've seen this quite a bit, they were in a relationship with an abusive man and they were being abused, and he was also abusing her child or their child, and he kills the child. And then she is incarcerated, often for longer than he's actually incarcerated. So that's one thing we sort of see. She's because she failed to protect the child. And if you look at the nuance of a lot of these cases, it's like sometimes she wasn't even there. Sometimes it would have, I mean, sometimes I've seen, you know, interviews with the woman after, totally beaten up. Like, she has two black eyes, a split lip, like clearly... She was really injured during this, and she's in prison for murder of this child, her child. And another thing that we kind of see is something called the girlfriend problem, which is where a woman will be involved with a man who is in some sort of criminal circle. I say that very broadly. And say it's a drug, something having to do with drugs. She's not drug dealing. She's not doing any of that. But when they're arrested, he just has more information. He's more connected and he knows how to work the system better. So he has a lot more to offer. So he can often get out of that, you know, make a deal, make a plea, knows how to do it. And she doesn't have anything to offer because she's not really that involved. And she gets all this time. So that's called like the girlfriend problem.
It's so interesting. And it's, you know, what you were talking about with the failure to protect laws. That's kind of the same sentiment that I have. It's like they have this weird, as Americans, at least, this weird bias towards, well, it's a mom's job to take care of a kid. And we, you know, at my house, my wife and I don't have, we're like opposite gender roles in most things. People make fun of us for it. So I don't get it. Like, we were some friends having dinner the other day, and the guy was bitching about his wife never cooking dinner and they have to eat out all the time. And he works from home. And I was, and it was like, I was the weirdo, because I'm like, why aren't you cooking dinner? Like, what? That doesn't make any sense to me. Like, what? But it's weird. Like, that sentiment tends to it. There's ripples of it through our criminal justice system. The other, and I think the statistic I was pulling, it wasn't necessarily when the husband is killed. It was had more to do with, if I'm remembering correctly, if the husband is killed and the woman has had an affair.
Oh, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, compared to, you know, the opposite with men. It's like it's almost expected, or it's not, jurors don't weigh that information as heavily if it's a man was. It's almost like they're just like, well, yeah, men have affairs. That's no reason to kill anybody. But if a woman does it, it's like, oh my God, she was having an affair, so she must have killed her husband. It's just a weird bias, I think.
I think it's also, there's a lot of like heat of like sort of crime of passion where it's like, you know, if there's any perception that she cheated, well, yeah, like who wouldn't kill her? You know, on the other flip side mm-hmm. of that, and a lot of forgiveness from jurors for that. But, you know, this stuff, and we talk about this, I don't think on episode one that you listened to, but as we get into the show, we talk a lot about how this is baked into this is written into our laws. Like our laws are based on old sort of puritanical English jurists who were totally down with the witch trials. We're like really like mm-hmm. doing precursors to these witch trials, and who also would very much, said, because they were men of their time, that credibility, that chastity is related to veracity when it comes to a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the more chaste a woman, the more virginal, the more truthful. I mean, and that was like written into law. And until I think the 1980s, if a woman said she was raped, you would parade through the courtroom witnesses who would say that she was promiscuous. And that would be like, so therefore she couldn't have been raped. And, you know, we have marital rape exception in our laws where mm-hmm. And that's from I don't know if we still have it. It's still treated with leniency, but until like the 90s and even today, there's loopholes where you just can't be raped within a partnership. Once you give consent by being with someone, that consent is forever. And that used to be in strict law. Like it was said something in like old English, something like, wherefore, you know, she has given, like signed into this marital contract, she forever gives consent and it cannot be revoked. That was just the law. So these things are, you know, they unravel into every part of our system and into our society. But for a long time, and I would say still at some level, that's okay. That's the way it's supposed to be. I don't believe that, but that has been written into what we're allowed to do.
Yeah, and it's certainly like embedded into the minds of, we see it in jurors, and those laws, you know, the way things went up through the 80s and it continued today, better but not fixed. You know, that's the reason that sexual assaults are like the most underreported crime in the country, and they're, it would seem they could be provable. It's a crime where there's typically forensic evidence and things, but at the same time, then there's this whole, well, was it really not consensual? It's his word against mine, and I don't want to go through that. I don't want to go through reliving what my, you know, it shouldn't be a defense at all if someone is, you know, quote unquote promiscuous, that, you know, because they've chosen these partners, that doesn't mean that anybody just gets to decide that, well, I'm choosing you, so since you typically choose multiple partners, then I just get to.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the whole idea of the perfect victim, which is a lot about what Believe Her, the show, is about. It's the idea that, you know, who's the perfect victim? We have all of these rules as to,
right,
and often the perfect victim is dead. Like, that's one way to prove that you're the perfect victim.
Right. Well, that goes so much, like, I was just talking about this with another podcaster yesterday. Jamie Pultz is an Australian podcaster. We were just talking about how, you know, like stalking and domestic violence go that way. You know, we just saw it recently. I don't know how compared to when this airs, but in the Gabby Petito case, where the police were actually on scene and saw what was going on. But Jamie told a story about when he was a police officer, how like he was in a domestic violence situation, and, you know, the woman, you know, changed her mind and didn't want to report, and his hands were tied, and then she ends up dead. And it's the same thing. Yeah, that's like the perfect victim. They're afraid. It's so hard to prove and they don't want to go through it. And yeah, they become the perfect victim when that continues to escalate because nobody does anything about it until they're dead. And right. Then it's like, oh, now we have a...
What a tragedy.
We can close this case.
So sad. Yeah. If only, you know, if only mm-hmm. it had been stopped sooner, except that we didn't. And right, now she's right. dead. Or she's alive, as in the case of Nikki Adamando. She didn't die. And then that's a whole other problem, which is a lot of what I look at in my work. It's like, what happens when she doesn't die, you know?
Right. And so let's talk. I want to talk about the podcast. It's called Believe Her. It's brought to us by the podcast network Lemonada. You may have heard of them. This is their 16th podcast. They put out Good Grief, Last Day, No One Is Coming to Save Us. Those are some titles that you may be familiar with. And we're about to launch. What is the launch date for Believer?
October 21st, the first two episodes drop, and then one a week for a total of six. That. So for another month after that, yeah.
Right. And I believe we have worked out with Erica that this episode should be dropping the day before on October 20th. So as you're really? Listening to this in the True Crime Binge Time Machine, tomorrow is the release of the first two episodes of Believe Her. And as I said, I've heard the first episode. It's fantastic. Can't wait to hear the second one. But tell us a little bit about first of all, how did you, so you kind of became a podcaster. You were a journalist, you were in Italy, you were writing books, and then now you're a podcaster. How did that come to be? Did someone reach out to you about something you'd written?
So when I was doing this, I was writing an initial article on the Nikki Adamando case, which is what this podcast is about. And I was doing this sort of deep dive into it. And I was going around this town of Poughkeepsie, New York, which is this upstate New York town where this killing took place, where this woman named Nicole Adamando killed her partner, a man named Chris Grover, who she said had really terribly abused her. She said it was self-defense. And I went to look into this case. And I reported it like it was just an insane sort of 18-month endeavor of reporting. But as I was doing it, I was like, and I was doing long form, like a very long piece, but I was like, this just is not at all able to be contained in 9,000 words. Like, this is a crazy story. And everyone had these really big characters and they all had these kind of New York-y mm-hmm. accents. And every time you would look after, you would kind of travel after one part of the case, it would open up to like 46 different things. And I just thought, this really is a podcast. Like, I wasn't a podcaster, but I do love them. And I just recognized that this medium, it couldn't be contained in print, which is what I usually do. It really would be great for a podcast. I think I shopped it around places and everyone said, sorry. And that was a weird thing that I had that was happening at that time. This topic, this subject matter for a couple years when I was trying to say, everybody, there's something crazy happening in women's prisons. Everywhere I went, they were like, we don't care. You know, we don't care. Right. No, thank you. No response. And it's really switched around lately. People are really, really interested in this stuff. But I had plotted out a podcast. I had this whole idea, but it just never happened. And then my book, We Are Not Such Things, was published by Random House in 2016. That's that book about South Africa. Mm-hmm. It was published by an imprint there called Spiegel and Grau. Spiegel and Grau has since made their own independent multimedia publishing platform, I want to say. They're very new now. It's the same people. And they're doing all sorts of stories, like they're making stories. And so my editor came to me and she said, hey, do you want to do a podcast? And I was like, yes, I've actually been keeping tape and have this whole plan and I've been trying to, I gave up, but yes.
Right.
And then they kind of tried to find it's two women and they wanted, they went everywhere to find like who could, but we, you know, we know this story should be a podcast, but like, we don't actually know how to make a podcast. So can someone help mm-hmm. us? So they ended up partnering with Lemonada. It's also run by two women and they really got along. And that's that. So Lemonada came in and kind of partnered with Spiegel and Grau to, I guess, to kind of produce. Lemonada was like the producer of this podcast. And that was, they gave me a producer and then we made a podcast.
Hi, Uncle. local laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social.
Well, they do a great job with production because the sound design, the sound quality, everything is amazing. So we are talking about the case of Nikki Adamando.
That's good.
How her name is pronounced. Yeah. She was a 28-year-old stay-at-home mother, and she's currently serving. I have two things here. I see 19 to life, and then I see 29 years in prison. What was her sentence?
She was convicted, and she was initially sentenced to 19 to life.
Okay. Yeah. And she was convicted for murdering her boyfriend and the father of her children, Chris Grover, who had been abusing her. So if you kind of give us the details of the case as much as you can give us without giving away what's coming on the podcast.
Yeah. The details of the case are that in September 2017, Nicole Adamando shot Chris Grover in the head in their home at a, you know, actually, you know what? It was September 27th, leading into September 28th, 2017. So the day that we're talking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was like,
what's so significant? I know. About
well, I was just looking.
Today.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like today. How many years ago is that?
Four years ago.
Basically today. You know, the time is not exactly, I'm not quite sure exactly when, but yeah. They had two children. She was arrested. She was put in jail. While, you know, police and prosecutors investigated, they charged her with murder. She contended that it was self-defense and that she had been abused for many, many years by Chris Grover. And she had an enormous amount of evidence of that. And yet after a month-long trial, she was convicted of murder and is now in prison. And the podcast looks, and this is not unusual, what happened to her, right? Nikki's like one of many, of thousands. And so the podcast, A, looks at like, how did this happen? How did this go down? What happened? What, you know, because the prosecution and the cops, they say she's a master manipulator. She's a murderer. Mm-hmm. She's essentially a slut. She's a malingerer. She plotted this out. And Nikki Adamando says, no, I have all this evidence of being like horribly abused both sexually and physically for many years and all these people who saw. And so, and yet she's in prison. So how did that come to be? We kind of unravel that. We unravel her early life. We look at her early life and these threads of trauma and these family, these generational traumas and families. And then we look at like what comes next, because that 19 to life isn't the end. There's like a whole next stage of what's going on and what's evolving and changing, unfolding, and how and why. So that's kind of the six episodes, and it goes back in time. It goes forward. It really looks deeply at the night of the incident and everything that came before and the context and the legal stuff and all of that.
Yeah. And in regards to like some of the abuse and stuff, was CPS at their, was it that day or the day before that, like CPS had just been there right before this happened, right?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure it was the 27th of September when CPS arrived at the house to investigate reports that the mother, Nikki Adamando, was always bruised and that the son seemed anxious, the 4-year-old son. And they came to the house and they found nothing to cause them to like take the kids. And then the killing happened within 20, like maybe 12 hours, you know, I don't remember the exact time, but like certainly in less than a day, the killing, the shooting happened.
Yeah, it's insane. There is, from what I've read so far there and listened to, there's so many obvious signs of abuse. And a lot of it comes down to some of the stuff that I deal with on my other show, Truth and Justice, that with any case was seemed like some pretty dirty tactics by the police, you know, just listening to some of the interview that you share in her police interview that you shared during episode one. It was just so frustrating to listen to. It's like those classic police tactics, trying to convince you not to get a lawyer and to keep talking. And she is, she'd been awake for what, 48 hours at that point. She'd just been through a massive trauma, and she's nervous and she's scared, and they're drawing information, and she's rambling. They've convinced her not to get a lawyer, to waive her rights, to keep talking. And she kind of, she set her own trap sort of during that conversation.
Yeah. Do you think she did?
Not enough to convict her. No, I don't think so. But enough to give the police, when she couldn't clearly say, yes, he was abusing me and that's why I shot him, or that he was attacking me in that moment. She eventually was able to give the story of what happened, but it was jumbled up. I've just seen, I don't know how this case plays out. I've only heard the first episode, but I know from studying police tactics and interrogations like that and how they're used in prosecutions, I can already, as I'm listening to it, I'm like, oh, no, stop talking, right? Stop talking.
No. No, you have a dead body, Yeah, absolutely. But it's funny, he says on there, I think that the cop says something like, you've seen a cop show, have you Miranda rights? And she's like, no, like she really hadn't. And I thought,
yeah, she had no clue.
You've never seen it. I mean, as somebody who watched like every CSI and like every Law and Order, and I'm like, you've never seen a cop show? But she really hadn't. And I think I talked to her quite recently, and she was mentioning that she, somebody showed her, like in prison, there was a Prince was on TV. And she's like, who's that? Mm-hmm. She goes, who's that? They're like, Prince.
Oh, wow. So very sheltered.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. She had her kids. She did gymnastics. She was like a preschool teacher. Mm-hmm. She didn't know about Miranda rights. She didn't know who Prince was. She just wasn't worldly.
Well, at least the cop was nice enough to explain to her that what Miranda rights are a formality, I believe is how
you put it.
Just a formality for you to waive these rights. Everybody's doing it. Just do it. I want to go through my...
Everyone cool is waiving their Miranda rights. It's very chic to do.
Yeah, you don't want to be one of those losers who doesn't.
He
just convinced her, like, it was very clear immediately she didn't understand what it was. He didn't explain to her that, that this is your constitutional right. You don't have to speak to me. You can have a lawyer present. He slides it in front of her and says, this is, you've seen it on TV. It's a formality. She even says, she's like, oh, it's just a formality then. So I just signs away and then, talks herself into a corner, essentially. There's obviously many more layers to the case, but that's just something that it's a pet peeve of mine.
I mean, later somehow, the prosecutor also somehow convinced, and people were convinced to do this, all these people to go down and give sworn depositions under oath, mm-hmm. prior to the trial. So that was also, perhaps not, like, with a transcriptionist there sworn, and then they would have to go testify, and their testimony couldn't contradict these kind of sworn depositions that were given. There was so much where you're just like, no, guys, no, don't.
And people just, they do it because the police said to do it. And I always say, and it's completely off topic, but not really, but I always said, like, what if our system was set up so that if you get arrested for something, you're put in a holding cell, police are not allowed to talk to you because they're saying you're going to remain silent and you're going to have an attorney. And the only way that they can talk to you is if you request to sign off of your rights and talk to them.
That's a great idea. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
You should put forth that.
No cop would agree with that because if they're guilty and we need to talk to them, it's like, what?
I mean, if they're guilty,
then you should be able to prove it.
Yeah, figure
evidence.
It out. Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
you should put forth that bill. You should put forth a bill. I think that sounds like a good.
Well, I do have the ear of many legislators. Okay. So I'll make sure nobody cares what I have to say.
No.
But I'd like to rant and rave about how I think that we could fix the system. And how many wrongful convictions would there be less if people weren't talking to the police? I just recently saw a comedian Tom Segura, and he talks about how he watches like 48 hours and he's just blown away at how easy these guys break. You know, it'd be like, well, we heard that the perpetrator had a blue shirt on.
Done.
It's like, okay,
I did it.
Him.
It was me. I know.
He's like, what? I'm like, no,
no, wait.
Like, you killed me.
Did you even? I mean, yeah. I mean, the balance of power is ridiculous in those rooms, right? But I think also, I mean, for her and for like a lot of people in that position, I would guess you're like, I don't have anything to hide. You know, I think that's genuinely how she felt. Like she felt like, yeah, obviously, you know, this is self-defense, right? I mean, she was bleeding. She was.
Yeah. The way you just said that, she said it exactly like that. You heard in the recording. She said, but I mean, this is obviously self-defense, right?
And the guy's like, well, I can't say it. I mean, I couldn't assess that right now. But, you know, it's very interesting because in the dash cam footage, which it doesn't go in the show in full, you know, she ends up kind of waving to a police officer. She gets out of a car and kind of approaches him after this happens. She's in her car at a stoplight, not knowing what to do.
Uh-huh.
In between a friend's house and the police station. My understanding is she was kind of going back and forth, not knowing what to do. A cop pulls up behind her thinking that she's asleep in the car. And he she's really just kind of sitting there with her two kids. What do you do with an air horn? You run an air horn?
Honk it?
I don't think so. Isn't it? Don't you kind of? Anyways, the air
you
horn
pull
goes.
It. Pull the chain.
Push the air horn button. And she gets out and kind of talks to him. And for a long time there, for 2 hours, they're talking at that stoplight. She talks before she gets to the questioning room. She talks for 2 hours on the side of the road with police. And from my perspective, I've watched it and she seems to me to be truthful. She's just telling them what happened. And the officer is very polite, as they are. And then at the end of that, he goes back to his radio or to a cell phone. I think we don't know what happened on the other end of the line. Like, that's never been tracked down. And he says something like, the more she talks, like, the more I don't think it's what she says. But I was kind of like, based on what? Like, you just introduced that. You, just random officer, introduced that. Like, I don't think so. Based on what? You know, and I think there's that, cops don't trust anyone. They don't believe anyone, right? That's the way it plays out. So they already, you know, they already don't believe you once you get to the police station. And really having a, you know, somebody on a couch with a gunshot wound to the head already really sets you up where they're just not curious as to your side of things, right?
Well, especially like that. They don't have a question about who killed him.
No, it's not a whodunit. The show is not a whodunit. Right. The story is not a whodunit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Not in the classic
sense.
It's
just about why.
How does this happen? Like, what are we doing? Yeah. What?
Well, that's the thing is rewind, right? Like, this is a tragic situation. She's definitely in a tragic fight to try to prove that it was self-defense and all this. But what if the problem, what if someone intervened a week before that, a month before that, a day before that? What if CPS had done something?
Well, they all thought she was a victim. A lot of systems were involved. Everyone thinks you're a victim until you don't die.
Right. Then now you're the perpetrator.
Now you're the perpetrator. And we don't have, there is no, that is the fact that we don't have like a system in which there's some gray area. Like, you got to pick one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a dead body, you pick, if there's a dead body and you did it, perpetrator. But we're looking really a lot in the show at like what is the context of these stories, which I think works for all of these, you know, crime stories. Like, what's the context in which these things happen? The life context, the continuous context. Because if you really cared about the context and you really looked at that and you really wanted to make change, you would make change way before anyone ended up dead. Like, you would front end solution, not 2.3 million people in prison solution.
Right. Yeah. And I was just thinking as you were talking, I wonder what the statistics are for women in Nikki's situation who killed a man because they were being abused. their conviction rate or percentage compared to, say, an angry father who kills someone who abused their daughter?
Yeah, that's a good question. How would you ever find those statistics? But
I don't know that you could, but I've seen those cases where, like, the guy gets out, certainly not self-defense, but, you know, sympathetic juror, called a sympathetic jury or whatever it is, where someone gets off because, you know, there's this righteous indignation. You abused my daughter, and so I killed him. But if it's the woman, well, he abused me, so I killed him. All of a sudden, it's a different story. I'm not saying what's right or wrong in either context, but I bet you there's a difference there.
The question is really, if he abused you so badly, then would you really be strong enough to kill him? You know, and it's like, well, no. Like, if you're abused, you die, you get killed. If you kill, it's like people, nobody can conceive of how that would be. Like, abused people don't use force to defend themselves. They're just these, like, endless victims.
Their job is to be abused.
Their job is to be abused. Like, you're not, obviously. Yeah. That, I mean,
it's nuts. And it's frustrating. And then the stupid questions that come along with it too. Well, if he was abusing you, why didn't you leave? Like, that's so easy, especially like me, like a man, to look at it and be like, well, this is stupid. If he was so abused when he went to work, why didn't you just leave?
You know,
you could just leave. Like, nobody factors in, not nobody, but people don't factor in like the emotional and mental trauma and the gaslighting and the manipulation and everything that goes in. I have people that I'm very close to that have been through these relationships for decades, when they were either physically, emotionally abused, and just they don't leave for all those reasons. But it's so easy to sit back and say, well, she didn't need to kill him. She could have just left.
That's pretty much a direct quote from a lot of people at this trial. But, you know, what's interesting is when you say, like, especially a man to say that. I mean, this was a female prosecutor, and this was a heavily female jury. And there's something to be said for the perspective, that sort of perspective, which is like, well, I could do it. So why couldn't you? I mean, that's
right.
That really figured in. Well, people really make a mess of their lives. Didn't need to come to this. Well, no. Like,
yeah.
No, it really didn't. but yeah, I think certainly a bit, we go a lot into, like, why didn't she leave? Could she have left? Because that was always the thing. Like, she could have lived, she could have died, or she could have left. Could she have? And we look into, really unravel if she could have, and what that question means when we ask it or assume it.
Well, that's great. Well, I cannot wait to hear the rest of it. I don't want to go any further to give any more away. I don't want to spoil it for myself. But I'm excited in our time machine tomorrow,
both
of these episodes dropped. So her name is Justine, not Justin, Justine Vanderloon. The podcast is called Believe Her. It airs tomorrow, the 21st of October. The first two episodes will be out. Check it out. I'm sure it's going to be a big binge for all of you. And Justine, thank you so much for both the podcast and the work you do and for being a guest.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Bob.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
John Daly here. You know what day it is?
Neither do I.
I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily.
And the best part?
Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino.
Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.